the Iterative Podcast. I'm June, your host for this episode. This time around, we're talking to Le Yi from Odoodot and Narali from Frizz on rejection fatigue when fundraising. Now, Odoodot is an educational game startup for children between 7 to 12 years old, and Frizz is building tools for freelancers and independents to get hired and paid. Both are part of Iterative's portfolio companies, and of course, part of our community. I invited them both to talk about the often unspoken emotional journey that comes with fundraising, rejections, and what their fundraising processes were like and how they handled those rejections. Both of them were gracious enough to share with me their journey and what they went through as a founder. So let's jump right in. This is Narali and Le Yi. Welcome to the show, both of you, Narali and Le Yi.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
I'm super stoked for this conversation. But first, introductions. Narali, you can go first. Please introduce yourselves.
I am Narali, the co-founder and CEO of Frizz. And at Frizz, we're building tools for freelancers to get employed, get paid, and essentially live their lives without paying 20% commissions to other freelancing marketplaces. Yep.
Nice. Le Yi?
Yeah. Hi, everyone. So I'm Le Yi, co-founder and CEO of Odoodot. And at Odoodot, we are building the schools for the metaverse. So essentially, our ultimate goal is to have a game for every concept you learn in school. And we are currently targeting 7 to 12-year-old kids.
Nice. Okay, I'm super excited for this conversation because both of you, just for listeners out there, both Le Yi and Narali were part of Iterative's batches. Let me pull up the season. I believe, Le Yi, you were part of Winter 22. And then, Narali, you were part of Summer 21. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes, that's right.
Perfect. Okay, so both of them have gone through Iterative's core program. So they are the best people to talk to because today's topic is about rejection fatigue, specifically in how founders should handle rejection from investors. I'm not a founder, but it is common knowledge that founders go through a lot, especially when it comes to fundraising, right? It is rejections after rejections, pitches after pitches, right? So I wanted to talk to the both of you because both of you have gone through it. So we're going to jump right into it. I thought it was interesting because the both of you have different, first of all, the business is very different. That's number one. Number two, both of you went through very different, I guess, business trajectories. Narali, you were part of YC's Winter 21 cohort, Sequoia Spark Fellowship, and of course, Iterative S21 batch. And then Le Yi, I believe you applied to Iterative before, and then you applied again. And then you went through, I think you raised from a few angel investors after Iterative. So we're going to jump into both of them. But I guess, Narali, we can start with you. Walk me through the processes to get into these programs.
Right. So I think the thought process behind joining accelerators, whether it's Y Combinator or Iterative, was primarily the fact that, you know, I am a first-time founder, so is my co-founder as well. And we felt like it would be great to be surrounded by other people that were building companies and by investors that really understood what it took to get started. The great thing about joining an accelerator that's good is also it creates a great signaling effect for your customers, for your partners, for even, you know, other investors down the road. And so we just felt like that was worth it for us as people that were new to the entire industry in a way. And that was our mindset behind applying. But quite frankly, before we applied to both these places, we didn't really have any very specific goal in mind, in the sense we weren't like, okay, we have to get in and here's all the hundreds of hours of research on how we get in. And these are all the names of all the partners and all the other companies we've spoken to and interviewed. It was actually just a decision made in one of our Scrum calls where we said, okay, listen, these application deadlines are approaching. Let's just fill in these forms and see what happens. So I think the mindset was always like, let's just try and see if we get into these. And maybe the whole journey of filling up the form itself is going to teach us something about the company. It's going to teach us something. It's going to ask us the right kind of questions. And it'll help us get focused in some way. So yeah, I would say it was a lot of, it was trial and error actually. And we're really glad that these investors really resonated with our story and understood what we're building and why we're building.
I know you mentioned that you and your co-founder weren't really thinking of much when you applied to all of the accelerators. But I guess once you got closer to the next few stages, because eventually you did get in, what was going through your head? Because I'm sure at one point it was, oh shoot, we gotta do something.
I think, look, the best thing that can happen to companies is actually getting love from customers. And sometimes when we're in that fundraising process, we lose sight of the fact that ultimately the most important thing is getting your metrics right and having enough customer insights. So I would say, yeah, the impulse is always feeling like, oh my God, I need to really prepare for this. I need to make sure my narrative is on point. I'm able to answer all these different questions that investors will potentially have. And yes, you can prepare for all of those things. And we did prepare when we did understand, hey, we're going on to the next stage. But now having, you know, come over to the other side, I feel like, again, the most important thing that we could have and should have done at that point in time would have just been to improve our metrics and to just be so customer obsessed that between just two rounds of interviews, we could have shown progress in some way. And that's always a much better story to tell investors than potentially, you know, answering one of the 100 questions that they have. Because they don't expect you to have everything figured out. But as long as they know you're doing the right thing by your customers, I think that's the biggest way of showing confidence and progress between rounds.
I think that's a good takeaway for founders. It's important to get money, but fundraising is a means to an end. At the end of the day, you are serving your customers and the people that you created the business for. Layi, you were nodding enthusiastically when Nirali was talking. Do you agree? What are your thoughts?
Oh, I'm not enthusiastically because Nirali is like, me and my co-founder call Nirali our goddess because Nirali knows because we have asked her for help many times. So like when I hear it, I was like, oh my God, yeah.
That's right. Exactly.
Community work. I love it. Okay, Layi, let's jump quickly over to you. Okay, before we get into, I know you guys, Autodot, raised from a few angel investors, Iterative, and then you also raised from a private investor. But before we go into that, we need to tell this story. You applied to Iterative winter 22, right?
Yeah, that's
is that correct? Okay, that's where you got in. But that's not your first time applying. When did you first apply to Iterative?
So we got in the fourth batch, but we got to know Brian and then met him in the first, when they were running their first batch. So I think that was early 2020 when COVID hit.
Yep. I believe that was Iterative's first ever batch. So you applied when Iterative's first launch essentially. And then you got in, I believe you applied the fourth batch. So basically
yeah,
three
so
batch.
Like, literally three batch 2 years later. Close to okay. 2 years? 1.5? Yeah.
Okay. What was the journey like? Because I know, okay, you applied and then you met Brian and then you were rejected and then you guys were rejected and then you guys applied a year later. What was the journey like?
I laugh because it's like, wow, like so many things happened during that period of time. Okay, so for some context, right, I started the company with my co-founder right before we graduated from school. So we were literally like university roommates. Yeah, it was quite funny because we can stand each other in the room, so we should start a company together. So essentially, we went into this really not knowing exactly what we were signing up for. And if you were to put like our fundraising in a timeline, we only officially was exposed to the concept of fundraising, or at least like started to know what was going on 2 years in. So I studied engineering. My co-founder also studied engineering. I think very naturally, the things that we like to think about are products and like building and solving customer problems. So I think it was until like 2 years later when we joined this other Temasek and a startup X collaboration program called Hyperspark. That was how we met Brian as well, that we kind of got exposed to the idea that, okay, like, this is how exactly a fundraising process looks like. I would say that from 2020 to 2022, we really started off like blind as a bat, really. Like, I had no idea what fundraising looked like. And I think it's really some of the toughest things to learn, right? Because it's a private conversation that happens behind closed doors. Like, unlike pitches and stuff, you can refer to like pitches on demo days, but you don't really see what exactly happens in those meetings. And quite often, you know, you can't go in and say like, hey, like, can I join your meeting and watch, because it's confidential. So the feedback loop is so much harder and makes it so difficult to learn. So I think it really took us a while to understand. And I think we are still really trying to understand how to crack fundraising. But definitely, because we joined Iterative, it really has like made our lives so much easier. It was that one bet that we made joining Iterative, actually, that because if we joined Iterative, we can understand how to fundraise better, and therefore accelerate our process. And really, I think that bet, our best bet ever, really, like our best bet joining Iterative.
Nice. Just for context to listeners, we did not ask Le-Yi to say that.
Yes.
There was no script.
I did not get permission for this, but I really like love Iterative, so yeah.
Nice. Okay. Okay, so you guys got in at the fourth batch. And after Iterative, and then like you mentioned, you found the accelerator program helpful. And then I believe you guys raised from a few angel investors after. And I believe recently you guys also raised from a private investor early of last year. How was the journey to get there?
I think it's interesting because right after our batch ended, that was in May, right? That was literally the start of like the whole fundraising winter. So we were like going in like, woohoo, like, okay, let's raise some money. But then you see on LinkedIn, like funds are drying up, you know, like in the US it's like this situation, it's not there in Southeast Asia yet, but like everybody is scared. And I think you can really feel it. So of course, yes, we know that there's still money, but you can feel the risk aversion. Like people are more wary, and therefore it's harder to convince, I would say, as compared to, let's say, if you compare it to like 1 year ago. Like you can really sense that the appetite for risk has completely shifted. And as a result of that, it required us to be very adaptable. So that was when really like, wow, like I called like other founders, I talked to other founders, like Nirali was one of them. And it was about reshifting the strategy. Like if this doesn't work, then okay, like are there other strategies that are working better? So then that's how we finally arrived, like, okay, like, you know, raise angel money. We have like a few angels, we really love them, you know. Their parents, most of them are parents themselves. So I think that was very interesting. And cover the baseline, right, to essentially make sure that the company can survive for a healthy period of time, so that we are not put in a situation where we are in such a time crunch, such a desperate situation to really just need to raise and figure out the economics and make it work first. So I think it was really tough June to July, because it really required a lot of like adapting on our end. So yeah, definitely I would say the climate has changed from even like 6 months, like early this year. Yeah.
Okay. You mentioned you reach out to Nirali to talk about asking for advice, right? I feel like I need more color into this. If you guys remember, do you guys remember? I know that you mentioned a few things of what you guys spoke about, but could you guys explain a bit more? Like, what did you guys talk about? How was the call? How did it go? If you guys remember.
It was a while ago, but yeah, I think it's a lot of back and forth just on Slack. So the Iterative community is quite close in the sense it's very easy for us to reach out to one another and ask for feedback or help, or like intros to angels and so on and so forth. And just feedback on certain investors, like before you go to meetings, you know, just kind of being able to rely on each other for what to expect and how to do better in certain situations. And again, that's a great thing about joining an accelerator, is that it really builds that community of people going through the same experience. And yeah, even supporting female founders is something that I think both of us, like, I'm just going to be speaking for Lai, also take pride in, you know. So that's always the context of different conversations. Do you remember anything in specific, Lai?
I think it's also about strategy, because that was something that I completely underestimated, to be frank, when going into this whole fundraising process. And it was really something that I was not aware of. I mean, I hate to, like, you know, pinpoint it on something, but I think because I study engineering, so I like to think about, like, products. Like, 1+1=2, you know? I don't really care about, like, oh, okay, like, building relationships and stuff. Like, it doesn't come that naturally to me. So then I completely neglected this whole area that fundraising is about strategy. It's about ultimately how you communicate and how, in that call, you know, you make the investor feel through the words that you use, the communication style, the language. And even, like, it's not just within that one call, right? It could be a build up of, like, hey, like, okay, like, getting to know the investors, understanding, like, what are areas they're interested in. So I took a very, like, efficient approach, and I would say maybe that was, like, not the best approach. So from talking to founders, like Narali, for example, she shared, like, how different strategies would work better. So then it's a lot of those tips that helped. I mean, I remember talking to, like, a few other founders at one of the iterative events, and I learned that, like, essentially they took, like, 18 months really to get to know the investors and eventually bring them on board. And that was something that I, like, to me, it was like, I would never thought of that, because my understanding of investor calls is literally you go into the first call, they like you, you go into the second call, they like you even more, due diligence, and then you close. So that was a very, I would say, idealistic, naive, or maybe optimistic, overly optimistic perception of what it should look like. But it was really through talking to each of them, like other founders, that I realized that it's really not as simple as I thought it would be. So I think definitely there's a long way to go for me to really understand how to crack this. But wouldn't have figured it out had I not talked to other founders. Yeah.
And then even then, you figure that there really isn't any one, like, thing that fits everyone. I have investors that I've pitched to multiple times, and at all times they'll say no. It's like, regardless of how much progress you've made, they're just not ready to invest in you. So sometimes you even get those, like, recurring rejections. And there's, you can never have, you know, you can never say, hey, I know exactly how to fundraise and I'm going to be able to fundraise when I wave my finger. It depends on a lot of other variables and factors. And sometimes you just have to roll with the punches.
I think adding on to this, right, is quite interesting, because back when we started fundraising, like, first trying to fundraise and understanding the process, I still remember one of my first few calls, the investor literally told me, hey, Lai, that's not how you pitch. I'm worried for you. So I was like, oh my goodness. Like, I wanted to bury myself in, like a hole. Like, oh, shame. Yeah, but...
What did you say after?
I think I was, like, kind of shocked. And then afterwards, I asked, okay, what can be better? Yeah, so I don't know if he was testing me or what, but I think that was quite like, I still remember it till now.
Oh man, as I'm listening to this, I'm like, oh my god. it does sound like the both of you have spoken to a lot of investors, right? What's the most surprising thing? And like, yeah, I know you shared a little bit, but what's the most surprising thing about fundraising to you? And what have you learned so far?
I think the most surprising thing is that, you always feel like you want to celebrate as soon as you fundraise, or like fundraising. It will sometimes feel like, hey, this is, as long as I fundraised, I'm going to be safe and this is going to be fantastic. But it's not the silver bullet that fixes everything. You have to constantly show up every single day and continue working on the next problem that's plaguing the company. And ultimately, like we said in the beginning, it's not the end goal. The end goal is building something that's meaningful, that lots of people love and want to use. And ideally you want to get to a place where you don't need to inject external funds. You want to be able to build a sustainable business, right? Obviously, the speed at which you do it, et cetera, and how quickly you can scale is the reason why people rely on VC money and external money to grow. And that's a completely different debate on its own. But the fact that like fundraising from big established investors doesn't fix problems is something not many people understand enough about. And many people make the error of when they get started on the entrepreneurship journey, they make the error of trying to fundraise first before they've actually started building a product that's super sticky and that customers love and enjoy, before they've started getting those micro insights on their users. And a lot of times, even when, founders come to me for advice, when they're like, hey, I'm applying to Iterative, I'm applying to Y Combinator, how do I make sure my application stands out? My first feedback to them is metrics. You have to tell me, what is it that you know as a founder that no one else knows, that's so unintuitive because you have spent the time and effort trying to figure out what is going to be your secret sauce in terms of selling this product. And it could be insights that can be anything. It could just be something like, hey, I know that this one specific feature is the reason why someone will pay me a monthly subscription. And this is the reason why someone is moving away from a competitor. And I've tested this with 10 people and all 10 of them have said they love it. Even something as small as that is actually super valuable. And so, yeah, I think my realization is that you shouldn't pursue fundraising as the first thing ever. Like the moment you have an idea, it's not necessary that you have the funds to be able to succeed. You put yourself in a much better position by actually spending time with customers and getting those unique insights. And then the fundraising will come as a result of your metrics and your successes.
Nice. It's more of like a byproduct rather than the end goal. Le Yi, what about you? What is, after pitching and fundraising, going through the fundraising process, what is the most surprising thing to you?
I think one of the hardest things that I had to accept is that people could be wrong. Because I think when I first started, right? So, okay, you imagine, okay, I just graduated from school. To me, in a classroom, right, you have adult teaching you things. Right, and they tell you and you're like, okay, yeah, like makes sense, you know, this is correct. So to me, there was always this like, oh, okay, like listen and like, yes, what they say is correct and I should take it in, I should learn from it, and they will help me move faster because I take in their feedback. So then I think that was tough to accept. And I didn't realize that this could be happening because when I first started fundraising, I got very easily influenced by what investors were telling me in the call. Yeah. And I think my co-founder was the one that actually pointed out to me, right, that it's important for us to filter out noise. And that was really tough for me to learn, like really tough, because as much as you wanna, like, I mean, there's no textbook, there's no guide to tell you what could be wrong, what could be right. And it's really about trusting your own judgment. And that is really what makes it even harder. So I think that made the process of fundraising very confusing for me at the beginning. And I think it still gets to me sometimes, but I've gotten better at like being able to sieve out like sometimes what they could be saying is, it's not that it's wrong, it's just not for now. You know, it's not something that I have to worry about now, and it's not something that I should do. And I think it's uncomfortable for me to discard people's opinions sometimes, because I mean, I want to respect like people and what they say, right? So that feeling of like, hey, like, you know, okay, cool, thanks for sharing, out the window. Like, that's not easy for me to do. So I think that was one of the hardest and most surprising skills that I never thought I had to learn through the process.
Yeah, and I mean, just to echo Lai's point, right? In general, female founders are more susceptible to this because we have, if you look at just average, average female has a higher degree of agreeableness than the male founder. And because of that agreeableness, it's always that pressure, the feeling that, hey, an investor has been around in the industry for 10 years. If they think that this is the right way of approaching something, maybe it is the right way of approaching something. But the truth is that really, you know, you know your company best, and no one has spent those many hours working on the problem that you're working on. And so you should really trust yourself. And like you said, it's about figuring out what advice is something that's relevant versus what is just an opinion from someone that's never really tried to be in your shoes.
I think this is super helpful for founders. But I want to jump in. I guess I want to dig deeper into this. Le-Yi and Narali, you guys mentioned there is a fine line between people's opinions, right? Sometimes it's noise, but sometimes it's actually good feedback or like good insights. As a founder, how can you guys tell? I know there's no playbook to this. I know there's likely no right answer. But I guess for your own businesses, how are you guys able to discern that?
Okay, so I think it's tough because first you need to emotionally let go. Like you have to let go of the emotions that's clinging onto the sentence. Okay, so you have to come to terms with the sentence because there might be a chance that what they are saying is true and what they are saying is scary because it fundamentally challenges your business. So that therefore there's a lot of like anxiety, panic around that, right? And you have to like come to terms with it. And sometimes it takes hours, sometimes it might take a few days to really objectively think about it. I think then the next step is identify how critical the assumption is and whether or not it's something that needs to be tested out immediately. So for us, I think in the past few months, right, we've really, from talking to investors, there's really a lot of different opinions. But something that we really realized is nothing beats what your customers tell you and what their behaviors tell you, because you are literally building your business for them, right? And from there, justify whether or not the assumption is real or like valid or not. So, I mean, to give it a context, so I think because we are building educational games, and there are just really very few educational games in the market, especially for 7 to 12-year-old kids. So then as a result, there's a lot of, I would say, skepticism, you know, concerns of whether or not this could work. And as a result of that, you know, there's many questions around it, like, hey, like, are parents even willing to pay, for example, or like, is this education or is this games? Like, I don't understand like how this works. And for us, how we really went on to validate the assumption was, okay, like really, like parents are willing to pay. So therefore, okay, invalidates the assumption, and therefore we are still on the right track. So I think really being very grounded, as what Narali said earlier, that your business is really for your customers, and really letting, unless it's your customers telling you something, gotta take it with a pinch of salt. Yeah.
Narali, what do you think?
I think with suggestions, right? Like obviously there's all kinds of data, and there's, I mean, people can make all kinds of suggestions that could be on the smaller scale to the larger scale, and can impact your vision in different ways. I think obviously like first principles is your own business and your own metrics. So looking at what kind of issues are facing your company, and if you had to fix, maybe, I don't know, you had the power to fix one thing in the short term, is what someone else is suggesting of high priority. If it's not high priority enough at that point in time, and you feel like there are other things that you should be working on that can ultimately make the business better, make the investment a yes, then you should prioritize that. But then there's always a way to test different suggestions that people make in a simple or smaller manner before you drastically go and start changing your business. And so we'd always kind of bias towards some of these tests, whether it's in the form of going and interviewing your customers and asking them questions along certain lines. So let's say maybe you're running a business where you are earning revenue through a annual plan, like it's an annual membership plan. When someone comes to you and says, hey, actually, it might be better if you offer this for free, and then you figure out a different monetization strategy instead, right? With suggestions like that, you can actually A/B test them. You can actually go back to customers and ask them. And so, yeah, I would say bias towards running more small scale tests and then seeing if something that an investor has to say has merit. And let's say you do find something that's, I guess, opposing something that the investor is saying, or there's data that does favor what the investor is saying, you can always respond to an email chain or try to reconnect with them and try to get more information and show them that you're interested and involved in the process of implementing what they've, the kind of feedback that they've offered. And sometimes that really showcases your commitment to making the business better. And might lead to, like Lai said, that having that long-term relationship with them. So yeah, I would say there's never like one way or one approach that will work in all situations. But as a founder, you just become more and more comfortable with these gray areas the longer you've been in the business.
Okay, I wanna jump to rejections for a bit, because that is the main topic that we're talking about. Okay, again, because the both of you have spoken to a lot of investors, I was wondering if you guys remember the first rejection you guys ever received, because it's the first, right? Do you remember what was it like? And do you remember what you guys did after? Lai, we'll start with you.
That's a tough question. I actually don't remember my first rejection. I think like kind of lost track. You just get so like rejected so many times, right? It just becomes like, oh, okay, like it's normal. Yeah, I think I shared previously that like the most shocking one was when like during the call, the investor literally told us that like this is not how we pitch. So I think that was like one of the most impactful, rejections that we had. Yeah.
Nirali, do you remember, or it's also a blur?
Well, in the process of trying to build a company and like learning how to become a founder, etc., I had applied to certain accelerators before I even had a co-founder. So I would say that like way, way back was probably the first rejection. But yes, things do become a blur after a point in time. I think the learnings from that time probably again would have been just much better for me to be like, I feel like I was just too early. I didn't know enough about what I wanted, and that could show in my process of trying to speak to an investor or trying to get into an accelerator. And because that uncertainty was obvious to me and to the person that was interviewing me, like, I'm kind of not surprised that I didn't get in hindsight, right? So, yeah, the best thing I could have done at that point is just focused more on talking to users, getting those insights, and really building the product and the business out before trying to convince others that this was the best thing ever.
It sounds like both of you have obviously gone through the motions, spoken to a lot of investors. Now, obviously, the word no will change its meaning, right? Because maybe back then it meant something else. And then now, after like being in Iterative's community, talking to more founders, figuring out your strategy, I have an inkling that the word no means something different today, right? So maybe we can, Lai, we can start with you. I'm just curious, now that you guys have pitched a lot of investors, have received rejections, as well as acceptances, what does the word no mean to you back then? And what does it mean to you now?
Oh, it's just, instead of no, it's no for now. I mean, last time I took it very seriously, like no means no. Like, okay, I shall not disturb you anymore. I respect you. Like that was me last time. But now, really like talking to other founders and learning that like I think one of the things that I had to understand as well, right, is investors are humans as well. And it takes time to build trust. It takes time to show that you are committed. And yeah, like just cause they say no now, maybe they could see like how dedicated I am, and therefore it changes their mind in the long run. But I think sometimes it's really just very hard. I mean, rationally, I can say that now, right? But sometimes in the moment, it's just like, oh my God, like I put in my heart and soul into that pitch, that conversation. I was like so determined, very hopeful. It's like, I'm going to convert them. But, you know, it doesn't turn out the way you want. So, of course, there is like a, whew, like a, whew, like like a bullet through your heart at that moment. Yeah, so it does feel that way. But after a while, you realize that it's fine. Not gonna lie, sometimes we get kind of defensive about it. Like me and my co-founder, so we start like, they missed out. it's their problem. Their loss. Yeah, I mean, I think it's perfectly normal, right, to want to feel that way because, you put in so much hard work, you put in so much effort, you know, it's also kind of like a, I would say for myself, self-pity lah. So there's always these emotions that I go through, like, oh my god, like I'm just like really slogging through this every day. They do not see that, you know, and then all they have to do is just say no, you know, two letters, that's it. And oh, like, yeah, that's tough. But I think over time, it gets better. I started gymming as well, as you can see from my shirt. I signed up for a gym inspired by Brian because he said that throughout fundraising, he started gymming too. So I was like, oh, okay, yes, exercise helps. And it really does help, yeah.
Yeah, there's obviously all the emotional elements of dealing with a no. The best thing actually for me was just going and looking at memes on Instagram and on Twitter. I just love reading VC memes and that just makes everything feel a lot less serious. But yes, in the beginning, a no just meant like, oh my God, everything I'm doing is absolutely wrong. Why did I quit my job? There's all this self-doubt that quits in, right? And that like seeps in. But now a no is like, okay, well, I guess this is not the right time for them. There's so many different factors that can go into things. And, you know, I guess this just means I need to like make sure we are better in this respect or that respect. And maybe there's just, maybe our paths will cross again, maybe they won't, but it doesn't really matter that much as it used to.
Nice. It sounds like the meaning, I mean, it's still a no, but the meaning definitely changed, right? And I love that you guys mentioned ways to cope, right? Because being a founder is tough, but I'm very happy to hear that you guys, the meaning changed, right? And you guys are able to, I guess, discern and say that, okay, it's a no for now, or it's a no, maybe in the future, right? And then you guys will obviously reach out again. Again, it sounds like there's a lot of emotional fatigue. Was there at any point in time during the fundraising process that you guys felt like giving up, or maybe your co-founder felt like giving up? And if so, what kept you guys going?
So the process of fundraising, I think, isn't just like, you don't really set like one time period where you'll do it and then, you know, you'll stop after that for a few months. It's more or less an ongoing process. Yes, there's certain periods where you are, you know, trying to take on a lot more meetings and you're really concentrating your efforts to raise funding. But as an entrepreneur, you kind of realize that you're almost always in fundraising mode in a sense, right? You're always putting your best foot forward and you're making sure that your company is going to a place where more and more people want to be a part of it. So I'd say it's never like, oh, hey, the fundraising process isn't going well, let's pause it for a while. Or I would rather say you don't really go through a phase where, you know, you decide to stop fundraising indefinitely. It's more just saying, okay, maybe it's better to prioritize other activities at this point in time if we're getting a lot of very similar rejections for similar reasons. If things change, well and good. If things don't change, you know, then we have to take a hard look at where the business is heading and make some drastic choices. So yeah, I would say it's not really like I've never thought of, hey, I'm going to be giving up on the fundraising process. It's always, hey, how can I improve and what can we take away from this?
All right, Lee.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I learned the hard way is literally what Narali said, right? That fundraising is not something that you can just switch on and then switch off. Those days are over. It's really something that if I had to put like a visual term to it, right, it's literally this tree trunk that you are just pulling along with you while you're running your business. Like you cannot drag, like you cannot just leave it, but you have to pull it, and it's a weight that is heavy, but you have to pull it. Like, and it's about consistency. I think, so for sure, like, there were times where, like, oh my God, like, why am I doing this to myself? I can just go and find a job and be free. But having a co-founder helps. So because I think how we split our work is that one of us does the fundraising and the other handles the operations, right? And I think it's great. I have huge respect for solo founders because I really don't know how they balance both. But for me, it's great because my co-founder, Wong Lei, pulls me out of whatever spiral that I'm going in and helps me reframe the whole situation. And I realize, like, okay, it's not as bad as I think it is, or I'm, like, beating myself up too hard, or, like, you know, we just literally just, like, oh, like, spiral and, like, gossip together, right? So, I mean, it helps, but yeah. So I think that really helps me manage the downsides to fundraising. If I had to put, like, a meme, like, Narali likes memes, right? So if I had to put a meme to this whole fundraising process, it would literally be, like, I'm not sure if you all have seen it, but, you know, there's this girl performing, like, in a dance with, like, many other girls, and then she's just, like, crying, but she's still doing the dance.
I've seen that one.
The meme fundraising. Yes. 100% story of fundraising life, really. So, yeah,
Yeah, that will be something that I accompany when this podcast is published. I will add that meme to illustrate your point.
Give them a reference.
Okay. Guys, you guys have spent so much time with me and I really appreciate it. I think founders will definitely find a lot of actionable insights from this conversation. But let's wrap it up by giving key takeaways, right? For the founders who are new to fundraising, what advice, or I guess you guys have already given a lot of advice, but I guess key takeaways from this call, what would you tell founders who are new to fundraising?
Yeah, maybe I'd tell them to start with some clarity on exactly, you know, how much they want to raise, what terms, why they want to raise, and have some clarity in terms of where the business is currently in terms of metrics and how the fundraising is going to improve it. Just answering all of these questions sometimes helps a lot to understand even if it's the right time to fundraise. Because sometimes it's very easy to get caught in the hype and it's very easy to feel like, oh, there are so many companies that are announcing rounds and there's so many people that are going after money. But yeah. It just comes back to the fact that fundraising is like a pill you have to take to survive, but it's not the purpose of your existence, you know. And yes, so that's I guess my feedback is it's not the most important thing you should be spending your time on, and the only thing you should be spending your time on.
Mm-hmm.
I think for me, right, one of the skills that I wish I started training myself in was really the ability to sell. And I think because I went and I studied engineering, it was really a skill that I completely underestimated. Like, to me, it was like not important. But only after I started fundraising, I realized that it's such an important skill. And it takes time to understand how it works. Yeah, like, I think engineering founders out there really, I think, do not underestimate the importance of communication and selling. It's an art and it takes time to hone. Yeah.
All right. I think that's a good way to wrap up the show. Thank you, the both of you, for spending so much time with me. Narali and Leyi, please share where can listeners find you or your business.
You can find me on LinkedIn. So my New Year resolution for 2023 is to make more founder friends. So I would love to hang out with anyone. Also, I think you can follow us on Instagram, Autodot Kids, Facebook, or our LinkedIn, Autodot, or you could go to our website, autodot.com.
Yep, likewise. So you can find us on usefrizz.com. And I mean, personally, just drop me a message on LinkedIn. I'm usually very, very responsive. And yeah, happy to get in touch and answer questions as and when they come up.
All right. Thank you both.
Thank you for having us.
If you like this episode, do subscribe and leave us a review at wherever you listen to your podcast. We'd love to know what you think. If you prefer to read as well, we have a bi-weekly newsletter called Iterative Insights. This is where we break down startups, growth, fundraising, pretty much anything else that stresses you out as a founder in Southeast Asia. It's easy to subscribe. Just go to iterative.substack.com. That's iterative.substack.com. Thank you for listening and stay tuned for the next episode.